Hey.
Now, take a look at that map. Are you ready to go or shut up?
No, don't ever shut up. Continue to talk to us about this map now. I know we're recording, but we're recording in the green room, so that's okay. Go ahead. This is amazing.
The sizes on this map are right. The locations are right. The shapes are distorted. You have to compare this. You have to compare this map to any other map that you've ever seen before. You see the size of Africa on this map?
Yes. Huge, enormous.
Yes. Huge, enormous, because Africa is huge, enormous, and it isn't a country. Look at the size of Greenland on this map. Can you see it?
Tiny.
Yeah, and look at South America.
Yep.
According to this map, this map is right. South America is 9 times larger than Greenland.
Okay.
Now, you don't see that on any other map. Look at
not at all.
Alaska on this
all
map
right.
is smaller than Mexico, which is the truth. On most maps, Alaska is larger than Mexico. And on this map, the equator is at 0 degrees, which is right here, halfway between the North Pole and the South Pole.
Yep.
Those are important facts that we should be teaching students in schools, and we aren't. We're using the Mercator projection map, which was made deliberately to show the superiority of the white countries in which there were Christians.
Yes.
Wow.
So that we miseducate people on a daily basis, K through 16, K through forever, because if you go to a travel agency, you'll see the Mercator projection map, a great big wall-sized map on the wall, which is not accurate. It's good for training navigators, but it is not worth a darn for training students.
Wow. Now, what map is this called? What is this called? What's the name of this map that we should get?
This is the Peters projection map. And at the bottom of the map, I'll give you this information because I think you ought to have it. You get it from Friendship Press, Post Office Box 37844, Cincinnati, Ohio, 45222, or simply Google it. Google the Peters projection map, and you'll get it from the ODT company, and they'll send you, if you, Philippe Matthews, in your position, send these people a letter or send them an email ordering that map, they'll send you dozens of things. Because they, and you, Dr. Battalore, they'll send you tons of things because they want to get this map out because it's a new view of the world. It's a more sane and a more factual
honest,
and a more
truthful
view of the world.
Well, I'll send them the show. How about that? No, I've never seen this before.
And you haven't, Dr.
I've
Battalore?
I've heard of it, but I've never seen it.
I have not, Jane.
See, this is unfortunate because it's one of the ways we teach children how to see their world. And in the Mercator projection map, the United States is in the middle of the map. So that my map doesn't show
the US in the center, and Africa's nice and big, but Greenland is huge on this thing.
You're right.
And Mexico small. So yeah, I would very much like to, as soon as we get off the air, I'm gonna send in my request.
Yeah, they'll be delighted. Use my name and they'll be even more delighted because I tell this to every time I do a college, I show the difference between the Mercator map and the Peters projection map. And teachers, faculty members go, I didn't know this. And it's like, how dare you bring this to me? I say, well, hey.
That's why you're the teacher of teachers. That's why you're the teacher of teachers. All right, so we're getting started here. This is amazing. Yeah, I know. That was all in a green room, family. How about that? This is what we do before we even go live, and we're live, but this is what we do and how we do it. Okay, historical day, historical moment. Didn't know if I could pull this off, but we did. Two of my favorite people, Dr. Jacqueline Battalore and Jane Elliott, is with us today to talk about the concept of white privilege, if it is, if it isn't. And let's do some quick introductions as if they really need to be introduced, but you know, I'm a good host. So Dr. Jacqueline Battalore is a professor of sociology in what is it? St. I forgot where you work.
St. Xavier University in Chicago.
St. Xavier University in Chicago. I say it a million times. St. Xavier University in Chicago. She's the author of Birth of a White Nation. And she's also a former Chicago police officer. We won't hold that against her too much. But she is absolutely a welcome scholar and guest on a reoccurring welcome scholar and guest on our show. Welcome back, Dr. Battalora.
Thanks for having me, Philippe.
And the lady who needs no introduction, but definitely will receive one, Jane Elliott, is the author of A Color in My Pocket, Blue Eyes, Brown Eyes Exercise, a book that I had to kind of threaten her and her family to do and finally release about 2-3 years ago. She's an internationally known teacher, lecturer, and diversity trainer, and a recipient of the National Mental Health Association Award for Excellence in Education. She exposes prejudice and bigotry for what it is, an irrational class system based upon purely arbitrary factors. Welcome back, Jane Elliott.
Well, thank you, but I have to argue about something, naturally. I'm not a diversity trainer.
I don't. Then take it off of your bio, off your website.
I'm not a trainer. I'm an educator. And the word educator comes from the root duck deuce, which means lead, the prefix e, which means out, the suffix ate, which means the act of, and the suffix or, which means one who does. I am not a trainer. A trainer, we train members of the military and dogs and horses to react to certain stimulus in certain prescribed ways. That's not what I do. I'm an educator. Mm-hmm. I lead people out of ignorance. I leave that up to people who are toilet training their children. After that, unless you're in the military, you don't need to be trained, you need to be educated. Am I being overly fussy about that? I think not.
No, you're being Jane Elliott about that, which is what
right.
We love. That's that's the reason why you're here. All right. So thank you for that, Jane, for that clarification between trainer and educator. So we just had a Super Bowl, and we saw the parade and the hoopla, and we saw masses and masses of mostly white men out there jumping on cars and breaking up things and turning over stuff and tearing up the community, and not once were they called a thug or they weren't, the National Guard didn't come out to stop them. There was no riot police coming in to quell them. And so one has to ask about this concept of white privilege. Mm-hmm. So I am going to start with you, Dr. Battalora, on your thoughts on this. And then I'm going to I should call you Dr. Jane Elliott.
No, you shouldn't. No, you shouldn't. No.
No, I know you don't like that. I know you don't, but you know, we love you. So anyway, Jane Elliott, I'll have you come on afterwards. So Dr. Battalora, give us a walkthrough, if you could, on your thoughts on this concept called white privilege.
Sure. Well, to link it up with the story that was in the news recently in response to the Eagles winning the Super Bowl, the reason that white people were not portrayed as thugs in our white media, and the reason in which riot police were not targeting and responding to these groups as if they are a threat to society, is because in colonial North America, when white people were first invented as a group of humanity, there was an alliance created that linked law enforcement with the presumption and with the privileges associated with whiteness. For example, we know that one of the very first laws passed to assert whiteness on these European laborers was a law that made it illegal for black people to testify against white people. And in that very first law, it's a great example of this connect made that linked law enforcement from its founding to white supremacy. And so because we have never unpacked this history, because we have never, because we continue to fail to shed light on white supremacy in all its everyday forms, we continue to see white people being seen in these most positive of ways. And so that translates in how white people are treated by law enforcement, how we are described by the news media, et cetera.
Jane Elliott, for 52 years now, you 52 years ago, you after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, you produced an exercise that literally has gone around the world and back and has changed the world and perceptions of this world. Speak to us about, in our first interview, which was a radio show interview, actually, about 3 or 4 years ago, you talked about colorism versus white privilege. Can you speak to this concept of white privilege?
Yeah, because this concept of white privilege has only been around for about 500 years. You need to realize that before 500 years ago, and before Linnaeus started categorizing people, humans, the way he categorized plants, we didn't have the problem of differences of color, because it was just simply taken for granted that there were differences in human beings. In about 500 years ago, because they needed a new way to decide who they were going to kill or enslave, they decided, instead of working on religion, because you couldn't always tell what religion a person was, they sat on skin color. That short a time ago. This hasn't been, people will say, well, it's always been this way. No, it hasn't. There have always been people of many different colors, all of whom are descendants of those first black females who originated in sub-Saharan Africa, about, they think now, 500,000 years ago. You see, the white people are only white because they moved, people of color moved, black people moved farther and farther from the equator. And as they moved farther from the equator, their skin got lighter and lighter because their bodies produced less and less melanin. It wasn't until the colonial period that we decided that white people should be declared superior in this country and in the UK. It was a lie then, and it's a lie now. We are all members of the same race. You and I, the three of us, are all cousins. Every person on the face of the earth is a 30th to 50th cousin of every other person on the face of the earth. So we should be talking about colorism instead of racism, because there's only one race. And if, as in Peggy McIntosh's list of white privileges, I can stand up and give my opinion without being criticized because of my race, since there's only one race, that should be true for every human being. But as long as you think that the skin color makes you better or worse than somebody else, you are ignorant. And it is my job as an educator to lead people out of that ignorance. If I don't accomplish anything else in the rest of my life, I am going to accomplish teaching people that there's only one race, we're all members of it, and what hurts you hurts me, because you're one of my cousins, and I will not tolerate having one of my cousins of another color abused because of some other person's, human beings, ignorance about color, about skin color, which is what it's all about. There's only one race. Now, not everybody agrees with that, and do I care? No.
No, you don't. No, absolutely not. Dr. Battalora, please respond.
Well, what is there to respond to? You are brilliant. You articulate it so concisely, so clearly. And it is the truth, the truth. Over 99% of the human genome has been identified. There's no gene for these things we call races. Race doesn't exist because
race is not biological.
That's it, and the whole concept of race as applied to humans, it's inappropriate. We are humanity.
We aren't flowers. We aren't plants. We aren't, and people who think, well, you can't, we must be different races, we different species. Well, let me put it this way. You can't cross a cat and a dog and get a dad or a cog. They're two different species. They cannot reproduce with one another. You can mate a person of one color group with a person of another color group and get a beautiful child out of that mating. That means we are all members of the same species. Get over it. It's time for us to look around and realize, for instance, about 3 weeks ago, my ex-daughter-in-law got her DNA, and you know, she did that thing to find out who she is. She thought that she was probably mostly of the Nordic strain. She found out that most of her genetic structure comes from Ireland, England, and 1.6% Nigeria. I laughed loudly. I thought, how wonderful. Didn't you not know? That in every one of our DNA is a memory of those first black women's DNA? Because that's the way it is. Many people, there are people in this country who will shoot themselves at the thought that they are actually part black. Well, that's the way it is. Get used to it. It's a wonderful thing to know
we're
that.
Probably, I don't want to be facetious, but we're probably hoping that they would eliminate this thing.
What?
So the people who might shoot themselves if they found out they were part black, that might be a good thing. I'm not saying that might be necessarily a bad thing.
No. You can't educate a dead person.
Right.
But can they? I mean, okay, let me push back on this.
That's why it doesn't work to try to educate Donald Trump.
Let me push back on this, Jane. And I appreciate this because, in some ways this is preaching to the choir. But there are some people. Look at the and I don't want to. I have to go there because it's my show. A lot of the people who voted for Trump, those are probably the people who, if they found out that their ancestry began in Africa, they would probably kill themselves as well. I don't know what that would do to the economics of the population of America. But what do you do for people who just absolutely unequivocally cannot be educated? Because they just there's this genetic memory of and socialization of hate for pigmented people.
You show them love. You show them Jane Elliott. You show them people who look like them, but who see the world radically differently and who are capable of manifesting love for all of humanity. Look, when Jane and I walk into classrooms, we can open doors. We can't force people through them. We can open them. And even for all of those people that seem to be uneducatable, I don't believe that. Because even seeing a model of someone who perceives the world and behaves in the world in a way radically different from their own mindset, that is an education for those people. And it may not transform them in that instant, in that moment, but even in my own life, I remember some things from my first year of college I can even give you a concrete example. So I remember this professor in college, it must have been a psychology class, but she was speaking about being present. I kid you not, Jane Elliott and Philippe Matthews, I had no freaking clue what being present meant. I really didn't. But I have reflected back on that later on in life as I was able to know what being present in the world is. So we are, even when I have my most frustrating days in a classroom or with an audience, I know that I have presented them, even though I didn't see them changing in this moment, I know they've seen something different. And it may not manifest today, but it may manifest tomorrow.
Mm. Jane Elliott.
Well, I do things that people can't walk away from. I tell them the next time you come up to a traffic signal, the stoplight, and it's red and you have to stop and there's a big truck beside you and the trucker's with the motor because he's in a hurry, he's on schedule, and you look up at him and smile. He thinks you're smiling at him because you think he's cute. He doesn't realize that you're saying to yourself, Sonny, right now, your life and what you do is being dictated by the invention of a black man. Now, when you tell that to people, to college students, they just howl because they know that when the Harley Davidson boys come up and they're sitting there wanting to go, and that invention of a black man is telling them whether they can stop or not. That is, and then I say to them, now here, let's do this. Everybody take off your shoes. Now put your right shoe on your left foot. Put your left shoe on your right foot. Now try to take three steps. How do you like me now? The last for sewing shoes together mechanically so that you could have a right and a left shoe was invented by a black man. Every time you put your army boots on in the morning, or your motorcycle boots, or your high heels, those 5-inch heels that you have trouble staggering around on, you are enjoying what was produced for you by a black man, Jan Ernst Matzeliger. People go, oh, and I say, now, everybody, take a deep breath. And everybody, because now they're afraid of me, so they take a deep breath. Like, 600 people at a time doing this is probably not a smart idea because it spreads a lot of germs. I say, now blow it out. Now take another deep breath. Now, folks, when you exhaled, you exhaled teeny tiny portions of your cells. Pieces of yourself went out into the air. And when you inhaled the portions of the people around you. So you can never be just you again because you have inhaled portions of all those people sitting around you. Now what are you going to do? And they just look like, and I said, now I'm going to buy stock in a surgical mask company because I think people are going to be buying a lot of them so that they won't be inhaling pieces of those who are around them. You can't avoid inhaling. If you want to stop breathing, then you don't have to worry about color. But if you're going to breathe, you're going to have to realize that you are part of every person you visit with. And he or she is part of you forever. That's the way it is. It sounds simplistic, but it's not really simplistic because that's the way we spread germs. If we spread germs that way, then don't we also spread those parts of ourselves that way? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do. We don't want to admit that, but we do.
Well, you're talking subatomic, and quantum physics is that, you can't get out of life alive without being connected with everything and the universe in itself. So that is absolutely phenomenal.
You can if you try. Lots of people try to do that very thing. Lots of people stay in their own little community with people who look like them so that they don't have to learn about those who are different from themselves. Mm. And that's the reason I wear this shirt that says prejudice is an emotional commitment to ignorance. Because that's what it is. If you can stay ignorant about those other people, if you can practice the golden rule, which we don't, the golden rule says, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. That's the golden rule as interpreted from Chinese philosophy by Christians. In Chinese philosophy, that rule said, do unto others as others would have you do unto them. Mm-hmm. A totally different concept. Treat others the way they want to be treated. I don't have the right to treat you the way I want to be treated. I have to treat you the way you want to be treated. And in order to find out how you want to be treated, I have to ask you, I have to listen to your answer, and then I have to do what you ask me to, as long as it isn't indecent, immoral, or illegal. I believe in the Platinum Rule, which says, do unto others as others would have you do unto them. Treat others the way they want to be treated. But that takes the power away from us. Mm-hmm. And we Christians do not practice the golden rule. We say it, but we don't practice it.
So with this ignorance that you talk about, Jane, Dr. Badalora, if you could, we've kind of demystified white privilege and gone deeper into understanding that. You know, I've had you on with Dr. Robin DiAngelo, who took Peggy McIntosh's work to the next level with white fragility. Which is where whites become increasingly uncomfortable when they are faced with the inevitable preponderance of overwhelming evidence as it relates to color, colorism, and what have you, and the cognitive dissonance. As one of my viewers was asking about white fragility and cognitive dissonance. Speak to us about that as it relates to dealing with the ignorance in these isolated communities with these people who are making a choice, in a sense, to be ignorant.
Well, Robin DiAngelo's work of white fragility, of course, is connected to the fact that because our society has been set up from its founding as a matter of law to confer unearned advantages on white people, so. Our systems, our institutions, from law to education, you name it, those systems were built for white people, by white people, to advantage white people. And because that is our history, today when white people are asked to think about, to feel the to consider racial disparities in our current moment, what so often happens that Robin DiAngelo talks about is that we don't have tools for coping with that reality that race has given us unfair advantages. And so what we do then, because we don't have tools for that, is these variety of mechanisms come into play. We distract, the white woman starts crying, oh, please, I'm wounded, take care of me, so that we don't have to talk about people of color and their harm. Or the typically white male response, which is both mansplaining and anger. You know, it's all connected, that the constructs that create that white fragility and those responses, it's the same white supremacy that started this nation the way it did. I think I love that Robin DiAngelo's work helped us to see the ways in which institutionalized white supremacy continue to impact us psychologically and emotionally.
Jane Elliott, your thoughts?
I've been hearing white fragility a lot lately, along with white privilege. I find it highly amusing, actually, that we talk about white fragility for white people who are going to have to deal with the fact that they aren't in fact superior, and that in fact the little coping skills that they've had to develop are nothing compared to the coping skills that Black women have been developing in this country for 400 years, and Native American women. We don't talk about Native American or Black fragility or Asian fragility because we just expect them to cope. In fact, what we are saying is all these other color groups are stronger than white people. We don't have to worry about them being fragile. We know they can take this nonsense because they've been taking it ever since we started to tell them they should. So I really, and I think when I hear the white privileges conference, I went to a white privilege conference once, I'll never go again. But when I hear them talking about white privilege, I realize that what we're really talking about is white ignorance and our supremacy is that we don't have to recognize the value of other people because we white folks are superior. But now we're looking at a situation which within 30 years, white people will be a numerical minority in the United States of America. God bless you. God bless you. And she will.
Hope so.
In 30 years, white people will be a numerical minority in the United States of America. You want to talk about white male fragility? This is going to get really ugly if white people don't learn the same kind of coping skills that people of other color groups have developed over 500,000 years. Well, we need to realize that we are not fragile. We can develop these coping skills, and we will, or we will perish. We are going to have to look at people of color as our relatives, as our cousins, as deserving of the same kinds of privileges that you and I have. Because if I, because of my race, can be appreciated, then since we're all members of the same race, so should everybody be able to expect to be appreciated.
Yeah. I just wanted to say a couple things. I know that Robin DiAngelo's work, she calls white people to get on the bus and get those tools and offers ways to advance the coping skills. So I think that's an important thing to say. But I also want to say one other thing, because I hear folks a lot talking about this numeric shift this demographic shift that's underway in this country where white people will be numerically a minority.
But 2045, 2050. I had one of the top demographers on my radio show, Kenneth Grombach, and all the numbers are supporting that rapid change in the demographics of America turning brown and black. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, here's what I wanted to caution about. I worry that we're relying on that numerical shift in ways that other historical moments have suggested we might want to be a little more careful. And let me be specific about that. In apartheid South Africa, we had a white minority that controlled and managed the white supremacy structure over a vast majority of the African population. So white supremacy in a society, it's about power, not necessarily about the numbers of people, you know, reflecting this so-called racial order. So I just think we have to be careful assuming that shift is going to necessarily lead to the kind of social justice change that I think we all imagine.
That's a good point. One of the things that to come on the end of that, Gronbach was talking about this 85 million millennials that are entering the workforce, that are coming out of college and going into the world. One of the key characteristics, and this group is larger than the baby boomers, it's the largest group of America in history, 85 million. And it's going to be women led, because mostly there's more women than men. Most of the women are going to have careers. Most of the men are going to have jobs. But one of the things that he was saying that in terms of consciousness was related in race relations, he said that most of these millennials, and he was including his, he was talking about his daughters as well, they don't seek, they are not necessarily prejudiced. Now, you know, we understand that they have been raised in a white institutionalized world, and they might not even be consciously aware of that, but they are not overtly, if you will, racist. And they also will be the generation that will have the highest level of intercultural relationships or intermarrying. So that can also be looked upon as a threat to the most ignorant of quote unquote European Americans, because they don't have the education. And so as a result of, they wake up every morning and they start seeing more and more people of color, particularly after 8 years of the Obama administration and black people in the White House. That was a hard pill to swallow, even though the America said, hey, you know, this is the ideal, we want to move in this direction. But the demographics are not supporting, in a sense, that ideal. But this new generation coming up, which I think is the generation that's going to change literally the world, they're not having that. And that's why you see, if you will, these ignorant European Americans out marching, if you will, and protesting, you know, Jews will not replace us and all of these crazy things. So when you start seeing white people marching, you know there's a shift coming. Go ahead, Jane.
Yeah. If people think, and I agree with everything you say, this is a ridiculous situation we have set ourselves up to lose. There's no way we can win if we continue to think that color is the main part of our personality, of our, or what gives us power. But if we could, in the schools today, teach that there is only one race, if we could refuse to go along with what Ben Wattenberg said. Have you read Ben Wattenberg's book, The Birth of Earth?
It took forever for me to find this darn thing, but it's on the way. But it, yeah, everybody, you got to get The Birth of Earth. It's a hard book to find because they really don't want you to have that book.
Because nobody wants you to read it. And they don't want you to read Nathan Rutstein's The Racial Conditioning of Our Children either. But everybody needs to read that one. It's absolutely essential that people who are in education read those two books, because then you'll realize after you read Wattenberg that the reason for the wall on the southern border of the United States is to keep those brown-skinned people out. We don't want this country to be in, have all those brown-skinned people, as if brown-skinned people like the Aztecs didn't do fabulous things before white people got here and started to kill them because we thought they were savages because they don't worship properly. If you read Ben Wattenberg, you'll realize that they are doing everything they can, the government is, and particularly now under this fool, is doing everything it can to keep white women from having abortions. Mm-hmm. When he wrote the book in 1987, he said that one of the three things we can do to change this situation, to keep America a white man's land, is remember that 60% of the aborted fetuses every year are white. If we could keep that 60% alive, that would solve our birth dearth. Well, I quoted those statistics at a college not too long ago, and one of these young men with a red hat on that said, the red cap on, that said, make America hate again, which is what it really means. He said, Mrs. Ellis, you've got your statistics wrong. I said, will you tell me your statistics? He said, now 39% of the fetuses that are aborted every year are white. 61% are fetuses of color. I said, you just made my point. He said, what do you mean? I said, that means that we are succeeding in seeing to it that white women have fewer abortions. He just was shocked. He said, I didn't think of it that way. I said, that's because you haven't been trained to think. You have only been trained to respond in ways that will get you a good grade in your classroom. Right. Start thinking. Right now, we own 39% of the aborted fetuses are white. Within if this person is president for three more years, which I don't think he will be, but if he is within three more years, that statistic will be down to about 25%, because we are trying to do away with Planned Parenthood, as if that's all that Planned Parenthood clinics were for providing abortion. They do wonderful things and provide wonderful services for women who can't afford the services that would be offered in the regular doctor's office. They are absolutely essential. And but you see, if we have this linear thinking person leading the country, and now this last week, I know you're going to think, well, stop talking about politics. We're talking about racism. Well, racism is politics in this country. Absolutely. Politics is racist in this country. You need to know that. Right now, they have decided that all the tips that people who work in restaurants get are going to go to the management instead of to the wait persons. This is ridiculous. They're working for $7 an hour, and depending on their tips, now those tips are going to go to the management. They're passing that law. I'm worried about that. I should think everyone would be worried about that kind of thing. Now, this week, we're planning on a huge military parade down the streets of Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C., which is mostly black. The inference with that kind of planning does not miss my attention. This is called power in action, people. We're talking about power, and we put our power in the hands of the wrong kind of people. Now you're thinking, she doesn't like white people. Oh, yes, I do. I'm not prejudiced about white people. Some of my best friends are white. Make no mistake about that. However, they're different from the rest of them. We don't all have to act like fools, which is what we were sort of getting away from that. With Jimmy Carter helped, and even the Bushes helped a little bit. Georgie boy wasn't great, but his father knew a little bit about what he was talking about. And then we got this fool. Because white people are so angry at having a black man in the White House for 8 years. I remember when Richard Nixon said to a group of white reporters, "I'm trying to save the White House for you white people." At that point, I decided we've got to change the name of the White House to the President's Residence. Let's have it reflect what it is. Let's have a description that makes sense. Instead of calling it the White House. There are lots of White Houses in Washington, D.C. But that White House is, according to many people, for white people. That's called power in action. And we've been exposed to that long enough. If those had been black women protesting, me too, if the majority of them had been black, that whole, all those protests would have been viewed in a very different way.
Exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, we do have what's now the. I remember someone sending me the FBI information on this new black identity FBI probe, and it basically targets anyone of color who basically protests and march. If you are, you don't have to be a member now of any organization like Black Lives Matter. All you have to do is show some level of support toward that organization, and you can be put on an FBI list. You can be removed from your home and work and held without due process. And so here we are again. Seeing this white power and privilege as it relates to the military and but the military let me state.
Can I say something about Black Lives Matter?
Please do.
When white people hear the statement Black Lives Matter, they think it says only Black Lives Matter. When black people hear that statement, they're saying Black Lives Matter too.
Mm.
And if they would just add a comma and the word T-O-O to Black Lives Matter, then white people might be a little less upset about it. But white people are seeing only Black Lives Matter because white people aren't getting out there and protesting with those black people. If all those white women who protested the Me Too thing, who were doing the Me Too march last week and 2 weeks ago, had gone and marched with the Black Lives Matter people, they would have seen that Black Lives Matter too. That we are all members of the same race, and if it hurts black people, it hurts white people, because we're all members of the same race. But as long as it's just a black, if it's just a black issue, we don't have to think about it. But if it's a black issue, it's a human issue, and it's my issue.
Right. I want to jump in too and just add to this militarized surveillance of black social action. You mentioned that if, you know, when Black Lives Matter do something, FBI is going to be alerted and surveilling and the like. But here's something else that is in a line with that, but far more troubling to me, right? Because if you know much about U.S. history, you virtually expect our governmental agencies to be involved in all kinds of social control, especially where non-white people are concerned. But I know for a fact that a number of non-for-profits, right? These are non-for-profit organizations centered around social justice, mind you. And in their own hiring practices, they will use involvement in Black Lives Matter, for example, and other groups seeking to advance social justice and equity for people of color in this country. And that is viewed as a red flag marker, even for those organizations. Mm. So you're rendered suspect if you support an organization that advances the human dignity of people of color.
Here I am, guys. Here I am, FBI. Come on, this is a Philippe Matthews show. Come on with
it. Not the FBI.
I know damn well I'm on some. I gotta be on some list, and I'd be pissed if I wasn't. That's what I'm saying.
But it's social justice not for profits who are doing that.
Oh my gosh, unbelievable. Well, okay, so you know, let's go into this even deeper. Now, one of the things that you said, Jane, I want to clarify. You were talking about Planned Parenthood, and we know about Margaret Sangamon and her agenda, and Planned Parenthood in the Black community, and the extermination of Black people and Black babies. And you had mentioned that they're a great organization. I don't want to get anybody in trouble here, so I want you to kind of clarify that for us, because that sounds like when Donald Trump was saying there's good people on both sides. I know that's not what you meant. So can you clarify what you mean by Planned Parenthood? Because in our community, we don't look at them as we don't look at that organization in a positive light at all.
Well, then your community has the right not to. But if your community is unaware that now Planned Parenthood is being used to increase instead of decrease the number of white babies being born in this country, you'd better take another look at Planned Parenthood.
Planned Parenthood is looking to increase whites versus decrease.
Being used in that way.
It's being used in a bad way. But it is also being used in a good way for a whole lot of women. And Black women can, if they choose, take advantage of all those advantages that are offered by Planned Parenthood. Unfortunately, in Black communities, Planned Parenthood does not see many white people demonstrating against abortion. Because if Planned Parenthood offers abortion in Black communities, that's a good thing as far as white people are concerned. You don't see riots outside Planned Parenthood clinics, either Black or white, in Black communities. At least I haven't seen it. I have seen it in white communities, because that's an affront to those white people who think that is Planned Parenthood is for the purpose of aborting white fetuses. That's not it. That's only a teeny tiny part of what they do. And the number of doctors who are willing to perform abortions in this country has decreased drastically since 1987. It's hard to find someone who will do that. So we will be there's a wonderful book you need to read. Another wonderful book you need to read.
I've got the list.
About a woman who performed abortions in, I believe, the Los Angeles area. You'd have to take a look at it. It was written by Stephen Bloom. Look up Stephen Bloom, and I can't remember the name of the book. It's The Woman's Name. It's just a fantastic book about what a service an abortionist provides. And that sounds like a crime to say such a thing. Mm-hmm. But I know women who, if they had had the opportunity and could have afforded an abortion, would have been better off. They would have, and so would their family.
So let's talk about that, because one of the things that was tantamount in making chattel slavery and the formation of these anti-miscegenation laws and the formation of America stick was Christianity. And so you think about, abortion, and they try to make it about religion, But is it about religion or is it about maintaining the white population?
Well, I think it's about now. I think it's about maintaining the white population. And I think thou shalt not kill. We don't pay any attention to that at all when we're going to have a military parade down the streets of Washington, D.C.
Good point.
Okay. That is about let's go kill. That's not, we don't maintain a military necessarily for defense. We maintain a military to be sure that we can destroy those who would challenge our power. And that's exactly what that parade will say down the streets of Washington, D.C. is see what happens to you if you challenge our power. That he chose to hold that in Washington, D.C. If that happens, this whole country should be up in arms because that sends the wrong message to the citizens of that city.
Do you think that's in response to North Korea and what you see sometimes in that regard, that they have these military parades and so now America is going to do so to show our might and power?
Right. Do we really need to have these phallic contests?
I know, right?
Around the globe, mine's bigger than yours. No, yours is bigger than mine. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's
such a male thing. You know it, and so do I. That's a male thing.
Absolutely.
And it's time to give it up. It's the whole thing is just absolutely ridiculous.
I was gonna make a really bad joke. I was gonna say, well, if that's really the case, then we should have a military parade in Africa. But anyway, let's move forward.
Right.
I'm sorry, family. I had to do it.
You are gonna be in big trouble now.
I am gonna be in big trouble. Absolutely, absolutely.
You know before we move on.
I'm sure I'm streamed right now. I'm being streamed live in the White House right now. I'm sure I am.
I want to jump in one thing because I don't.
Dr. Padalora.
I don't think we can or we ought to miss noting the tie between whiteness as it was invented and created and imposed in this country and its entanglement with Christianity. You can't even take them apart.
Yeah.
Part of the same package.
Nope, they are.
Go deeper if you could, because you're absolutely right. We don't talk about that enough.
But Christianity has been used to keep black people down for 2,000 years. And in this country, not 2,000 years, but in this country for 500 years, we have used Christianity to keep black people in their place. While we, which just kills me. Did you enjoy Christmas cards? Did you get Christmas cards with a picture of the Holy Family on it? There's Mary with her blonde hair, and her pale skin and her blue eyes. And there's the little baby Jesus looking just like the little Pillsbury Doughboy. Now, that isn't the way it happened. She was Jewish. She was born in the Middle East. Her hair was dark. Her skin was dark and her eyes were dark. And in the Bible, it says Jesus had feet of bronze and kinky woolly hair. Now, next Christmas, if you get Christmas cards, go down and buy a group box of Christmas cards with the picture of the Holy Family on it. Take it home and color them right. And then send them out. You won't have to send any Christmas cards the next year because nobody will want to receive a Christmas card from you because that is heresy, no doubt. People, you need to know that Moses, you know, God is not an old white man with a long gray beard that looks like Charlton Heston playing Moses. God is a spirit and has neither gender nor color, but God is made male because males wrote the Bible because females weren't allowed to learn to read and write. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing is just ridiculous. And it is belongs. If you haven't read Nile Valley Contributions to Civilization by Browder, you better get it and read it because
Anthony Browder, we're doing. Shout out. Absolutely.
Oh, my shout out for Browder. He's absolutely brilliant. Blacks were doing cataract surgery with metal instruments before they even thought of such a thing in the UK and in Europe. We don't realize those things because we've never been taught those things. If you're going to teach Black history, you'd have to start 4,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. You can't start with slavery. But in this country, that's when we start teaching Black history, is when we decided that they were slaves. And incidentally, I laugh every time I hear somebody say, our first Black president, Barack Obama. Well, Abraham Lincoln was our first Black president. He was part Black, part white, and part Cherokee Indian. He was a Melungeon. Do you think if people had been as angry about that kind of thing at the time of the Civil War that he would have been made president? People knew then, but since then we have tried to deny that or ignore it. So we don't teach history. We teach insanity on a daily basis. Mm.
Wow. Okay. So I would be remiss if I don't go even deeper into this conversation, especially in terms of how America is getting ready to is going through a transformation and being reshaped and reformed with the differences in melanated population versus a non-melanated population. So, and I'm gonna reach out to you, Jane Elliott, for this, because this is a question of someone that was pivotal around it in the time that you were doing the work that you were doing with the brown eye, blue eye experience. I think it was 1985. Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, the author of the ISIS papers, one who talked about the genetic annihilation, and she went on Donahue. And she said, you know, if everyone loved each other, she said, this is the reason why Martin Luther King was assassinated. She said, if everybody loved each other, Europeans, white people would cease to exist because of the dominant gene, of the male sperm. Your thoughts on that, as well as understanding, you know, the label of race and the creation of race. But your thoughts on that in terms of genetic annihilation?
Well, number one, I have a problem with love. Bell Hooks said, we will not have a loving society until we have a just one. If you love, say you love me, but don't treat me justly, I won't treat you justly, and we won't end up loving one another. Bell Hooks says, justice has to come first. And Dwight Eisenhower said, you can't legislate love, but we could legislate justice. I think if people of different color groups were allowed to reproduce, that we would have a mosaic society, which is what we have, and it would be largely non-white. That's the way it is. That is simply the way it is. However, when you were, by law, it was decreed that it was illegal for you to have relations with a person of another color group, that was racism in itself, and we're still doing that same thing. We're getting away from it, but not entirely, not in small towns all over the United States. Mm-hmm. You are seen as less than if you love someone who doesn't look like you, mm-hmm. or who doesn't worship like you, who isn't as educated as you are. These are not examples of love, of loving society, nor of a just society. These are examples of a bigoted society, and they've done studies that prove that the longer you spend in school, unless you really think about it, the more bigoted you become, because the more you are reinforced in the things that you learn K through 12.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. That's amazing. That's a good stat.
Well, yeah, but take a look at it. I can't remember where I read that, but those are the studies that we have studies that prove that. And you look at someone like a Stephen King from Iowa, who says that no colored people have ever made contributions to civilization. Practically all the contributions to civilization were made by people who were other than white. And we don't want to recognize that, and we don't want to admit it, and we certainly don't want to glorify it. We have to pretend that white is right. If you're white, you're all right. If you're brown, hang around. If you're black, get back. And if you're red, you're dead. And that's the way we teach in this country, and that's the way we educate in this country. That's not education. That's indoctrination. When we stop indoctrinating and start educating, we can turn this thing around. Now, hopefully, we will do that with the next group. I don't think the millennials are that just yet. I don't think the millennials are that unprejudiced. I think if the millennials had been that unprejudiced, we would not have this man for president. Right. Because they would have come out in droves and voted for anybody but this fool. But they didn't. However,
well, let's talk about that, Jane. Unpack it even deeper. Talk about the 45th. Now, you have the only thing that I would say is remotely similar to you and the 45th is the ability to nickname people. What is your nickname for this 45th, may I ask?
44 and a half.
I just absolutely. This is why we're going to vote for Jane Elliott for president in 2020. This is a setup right here, family. We're going to actually try to get this woman in. Okay.
Here's the problem.
Rex, what is your nickname for Trump?
Dinosaurus T. Rump. Because he acts like a dinosaur. Tyrannosaurus Rex. He has a face that looks like a rump. And I won't finish it because you'll just have to figure out the rest for yourself. But he has a mouth that looks like a dental aperture.
You can only imagine what I have to go through offline.
He outgushes excrement. Dinosaurus T. Rump speaks excrementally.
Wow. Why don't you tell us how you really feel about the guy, Jane? I'm just saying, you know, maybe you're holding back just a tad bit.
Well, he and I are both white, and I know white folks.
Well, that's deep. Go deeper if you would. I love that. That's great. So, you, of course, the comment about the shithole countries. And wanting to bring more people from Norway.
The countries from which we all came. That's what he's talking about. When he calls them shithole countries, he's talking about the countries in which humanity began.
His own ass he's talking about.
He's talking about.
Well, this guy didn't know Frederick Douglass was alive or dead, so I'm not really going to hold much for him to go that deep. I'm just saying.
I loved it when he said that Frederick Douglass is doing some wonderful things. That was last summer that he said that. I fell out laughing.
Maybe he meant metaphysically. I don't know, but I'm sure as hell not sure.
When he held up the Bible and said, I know the Bible, in 2 Corinthians it says, and I fell out laughing because I thought 2 Corinthians walked into a bar. The whole thing is just so ignorant.
I think this show is going to go viral, people. This will be the diversity model for everyone in diversity. This will be the show that you must watch. If you're going to train and teach anybody, this is the one. Okay.
Look, oh, I'm 84 years old. I'm 84 years old. I've lived through things that Dinosaurus T. Rump didn't live through. He was born 14 years after I was. He was born after the Second World War. He didn't see the commercials. He didn't see the newscasts of Jews who were nothing but skeletons being released from the concentration camps. He didn't see those things. He didn't have to. We had to. My father was old enough to go to the military, and he wanted to go, and he couldn't go because we had 5 children, and then my mother had 2 more, so that she could keep him from going into the military. We watched people leave and not come back. We saw the gold stars replace the silver and white stars on the board, on the wall of the building downtown, so that you knew who was still there and who was dead in a war that we didn't have to fight. He doesn't remember when President Roosevelt, when somebody said, Hitler, he said, leave that man alone. He's dealing with a problem that the rest of us don't want to deal with. He doesn't know any of those things because he doesn't read, and he doesn't have to think because he can pay somebody else to do his thinking for him. And that's true for many, many people in this country. We don't read, and we are becoming less and less intelligent. Well, not less intelligent, but less knowledgeable, because now we have those cell phones and those video games and television. And it is my contention that if you put a child in front of a television for 2 months who isn't a racist, at the end of 2 months, you'll have a racist, sexist person on your hands. And then you'll have to undo what television has done to them. We aren't careful about what we feed into our children. And we will suffer for it. You will suffer for it because you're younger than I am. I won't suffer for it. I'll be gone if you're lucky. But I intend to live at least as long as
that would be a sad day. That's going to be a sad day.
So yeah, if you're
I'm going to tell you that right now.
But you will have to deal with that which we are creating right now. And I don't think you're going to like it.
No.
When we talk about this new generation, let me ask you this. You made mention earlier, Jane, in passing. Because we're talking about the whole purpose of this show was talking about white privilege and to demystify that and get your viewpoints on it. But you said you had went to the white privilege conference and you said you'd never do that again. Walk us through that if you could. What did you mean by white privilege? You didn't like the white privilege conference.
The author of the list of white privileges stood up and read, and there were about, there, it was in a gymnasium in Pella, Iowa, in the school, and it was on Saturday, and the author of the list of white privileges, Peggy McIntosh, stood up and began to read her list of white privileges. About a third of the members of that audience were Black. By the time she had read the first five, ignore that, by the time she'd read the first five, just a minute, please. I'm busy, call later. The people of color.
Only Jane Elliott can.
I love you. I'm telling you. I just look. T.I. and Killer Mike. They say they love you, but I think I love you more than Killer Mike and T.I. I'm almost certain
what
of that.
Would
and
you, I'm what would you do in that
guys.
Situation?
But I'm just saying. Okay, go ahead, Jane.
Okay. Anyway, so by the time she had finished the first five, the Blacks began to get a bit restive. By the time she had finished the first 10, reading these things that say, because of my race, because of my race, because of my race, they had begun to leave. By the time she got to the 25th one, most of them had gone. And now she said, I have discovered 14 more privileges that I have because of my race. And I looked around and most of the, practically all the Blacks were gone. And I thought, well, Jane, the intelligent people have left. What the hell are you doing here? And I got up and left. Because it was offensive to me and it should have been offensive to everyone else. I'm busy, you'll have to call back. It should have been offensive to every white person in that room should have gotten up and left.
Wow.
But you see, it was making them feel good. Look at here, we are here and we're still listening because we want to learn. Because we're hearing something that makes us feel good and gives us ever more advantages. They stayed and listened. I couldn't stay and listen to that when my Black cousins were being offended and insulted once again, told that they couldn't ever be in the same position the white folks are because of their race. There's only one race. I think she didn't know at that time that there was only one race. If she had, she'd have said because of the color of my skin. And then it would have been totally ridiculous because she would have been saying it makes sense to judge people by the amount of melanin in their skin. It doesn't make sense.
Dr. Jacqueline Battalore.
Well, you know, this is a reminder for me of that context is everything.
Mm.
Because if you, and I wasn't there in Iowa for this, but I know if you read Peggy McIntosh's entire article that is unpacking the invisible knapsack.
Okay, get over here.
Then she makes it very clear that she is presenting this list, like where it came from and how she came to the realization, and that it was in contrast to how she saw the women of color with whom she worked in this women's studies program be treated. And she saw in contrast that when she spoke, people would listen. When the woman of color would speak, they were not conferred that sort of respect. When Peggy McIntosh would write a grant proposal, she knew the whiteness and what it wanted, and so she could shape it and was far more likely to be successful. So when you have the bigger context, I think that Peggy McIntosh's list of white privileges, in that with that context being very clear, can be powerful. And a motivator to get people invested, white people in particular, invested in learning this sort of knowledge about colorism, about systemic white supremacy, etc. And so it reminded me actually of, Jane, I think you'll appreciate this. I tried to see if I couldn't get people to utilize humor as a mechanism to raise awareness of white supremacy. And so I was thinking, let's do it and use, like, remember, was it Johnny Carson or who did the top 10 list every night?
Letterman.
David Letterman. So with that, you know, top 10 reasons it's great to be white. So if you do that, if a non-white person is reading that list, it was received in a way that was comedic. It retained its comedic intent. But you have
Let me ask you something, Dr. Battalore. Not to interrupt you. Not to interrupt you, but I'm going to interrupt you.
That's all right.
Let me interrupt you for a moment. Are we? And this is kind of an understanding of what Jane is talking about.
Yeah.
Are we doing a little bit too much to try to get white people to wake up that are just not ready to wake up? I mean, you know, if I launched the Black Privilege Conference, I think Jane would actually come speak at that. But I mean, actually, that might be a great idea. But, you know, are we just kind of working a little bit too hard here to get people to listen and learn when in some ways it's not? Is it really necessary to go to those levels and lengths to try and dispel their cognitive dissonance?
Well, you know what? Here's what I think. I think I have a yes and a no to that, because I believe that, like, this either or approach that is so, we are so dualistic in this, your Western European society is dualistic. It's just been part of our frame for shaping our brains since the Enlightenment. And so I really reject the either or approach. You think about Frederick Douglass in his debates over, you know, what do Black people need, and he was advocating for access in higher education, and you had Garvey, who was promoting training in vocational training, as if Black people didn't need both, and like, it's a false dichotomy. And so I believe that there are a variety of different approaches. Not everybody gets to be in a classroom with Jane Elliott. If we could do that, my hope for this, for the future of this globe, would be transformed like this. But because that's not the case, people bring a variety of gifts in terms of their, how they open up people's ability to learn and ability to change. And I know for me that some of the ways people have wanted me to repackage my work so that it can become accessible to Breitbart, I am not interested. I am not interested, right? But some people, white people and white people who have these ideals, maybe they can. And I'm not, I don't, look, there are a variety of ways to get us that are ethical, and I should undergird that are ethical to get, to help people transform their hearts and minds. And I think having a wide variety in with that purpose, if it's ethical, is a really good thing. Now, I would benefit probably most from being in a Jane Elliott approach. I think it's amazing, but the fact of the matter is not everybody gets to go through that process to be in her exercise and hear her quick wit, her knowledge of the wealth of things that she's read, the history that she's lived. Jane, if we could multiply, make you multiply, great. But until we can do that, we need a variety of approaches.
Jane Elliott, let me ask you this. One of the things that we say in the community, and one of the reasons why we are very suspect, even particularly there are people who say, why would you have Jane Elliott and Dr. Battalora on your show? You should have all Black people on your show. One of the questions that we talk about and have conversations in our community, and that is, can the people who have done us historically the most harm do us absolutely any good? And so we really have to ask that question, and that question, you know, not too many people get a chance to ask that question to historians and scholars in you don't want to call it diversity, but, you know, the white awareness industry. I don't know what the hell we're going to call it. But what do you say to that, Jane? Why should people of color trust anything that people of non-melanated people, European Americans and Europeans, why should we listen to anything that you guys have to say?
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, you shouldn't trust me. I'm a white woman. Right. I was raised a white woman. I was taught to be a racist. I was systematically conditioned to the myth of my superiority as a white person, but not really superior because I was still just a woman, but at least I was a white woman. So no, you shouldn't trust me, but you need to know that everything I know, I have learned from reading or talking to people of other color groups. I can't learn about people of other color groups because they don't choose to be in my presence. And they aren't. And for the first 18 years of my life, I was never in the presence of a person who was other than white. So I'm an ignorant white woman. You shouldn't trust me. But because I have learned a whole lot from listening to and watching and living for the last 84 years, I may have some knowledge because of what I've learned from black people that most white people don't have because they haven't looked for it. It's there. All you have to do is go to the nearest bookstore and you go down the line. And when you want to, if you're going down through the romance section, you'll find that the white romances have the full picture on the front of the book displayed on the shelf. But when you come to the black section, all you see are the spines of the books. Just that one little thing is just a scream. And I stand there, I've done this in Walden Books, and stood there and laughed because here it is. Here we can't have a black woman and a black man and a black woman or a black man and a white woman on the front cover of a book in this store, but we can put them on we can show the spine of the book. It's that kind of, that's what you call implicit. Well, it's not implicit, it's explicit bias. And we do it all the time without even realizing that we're doing it. Now, when you become aware and you see that happen, you go to the clerk and you say, what's the deal here? Why aren't those books shown front page, front cover, just like these are? And she's young and she's foolish and she doesn't know what the hell is going on because she doesn't have to know. When you go up to the clerk to check out and the woman ahead of you is a black woman and she's in Denver, Colorado, and the clerk says, I have to have three forms of identification before you can write that check. And I watch it and I walk up behind her and I start to write the check and I say, is it all right if I write a check? Oh yeah, the information on top check of this right, the information on top of this check is right, isn't it? I say, wait a minute, give me back the check. And I take back the check and I tear it into little pieces and I sprinkle it on the desk. And I say, now, what you just did to that black woman was totally, totally racist. This is a check from Iowa. She had a check from Denver, Colorado. You'll accept mine gladly, no problem. You wouldn't accept hers without three forms of identification. Mm-hmm. I don't do business with racist people, and you can take these books and put them where they'll do you the most good. And I left, and all those white folks behind me were really shocked. How dare I say that to that clerk? Well, how dare that clerk treat that black customer in that way? How dare we, as what we call good Christians, stand back and let that happen and either turn our heads so that we aren't witnessing it, or pretend that clerk has probably taken a bad check from that woman before. See, we have all this stuff, all these mental nonsense, this mental nonsense that you have to go through in order to continue to perpetuate the myth of white superiority.
Am I ranting? No, there's no such thing as ranting. That's not possible.
Now you're thinking, well, she sees racism in everything. I don't have to look for it. It's there.
It's there.
But you have to be aware of it, and black people are aware of it. And if you think that implicit biases aren't plain and simple to them, aren't obvious, you need to take another look. A black woman said to me last week, that's not implicit. That's explicit to me. I know when they turn away so they don't have to look at me. I know when they look at the ground instead of looking me in the eye. Those are not implicit, they are explicit to the ones who's on the receiving end of it. Excuse me.
Well, there might be a reason why she's getting all these phone calls right now. they're looking at the show like, oh God, we got to shut her up. Get her on the phone, call the number.
Shut her up.
some of these are probably death threats. I get those all the time. Hey, I'm going to kill you.
People from the FBI. That's what it is, Jerry. Yeah. You've been identified as a black identity person.
And they call me the B word, but you see, for me, bitch is an acronym for being in total control, honey.
Oh, gosh. Am I going to be like that when I'm 84? I don't think so. I'm not sure if I'm going to be that good.
All right.
Well, last question.
If this wasn't X-rated before, it is now.
Last question. Go ahead. And that is, so Dr. Battalore, one of the things that you've been able to successfully do is take the work of Theodore Allen and Edmund Morgan, and really bring to light the not just the invention of white people, but why the legal reason that the word white was created and that race had to be invented as a mechanism of control of a population of people. As I continue to study this work, study our history, both ancient history and American history, African history and American history, I keep coming to the conclusion of sociopathy and psychopathy of the folk that were responsible for the taking over this country, right. And that you have to be let's say that you cannot be of sane mind and sound mind to institute laws that dehumanize and subjugate a people that millions of people will be born into and never know the difference. But even before that, you got to be crazy to come to a country of people that are already here and befriend them, and then come back and betray them and kill them and rape them. And so there's a certain level of sociopathy. And I'm working with various different doctors and various different people on my show and off my show in terms of the axiological understanding. Is this genetic, or is this socialization, or is it a combination of both as it relates to the European? However, as it relates to this development and designation of this legal designation of the term white people, which did not exist prior to 1681, that started to become in the consciousness of the legal community in 1664. When we look at this being born into something that took another 100 years to create this concept of race, like Jane was talking about earlier with Linnaeus and Blumenbach and so on and so forth. It seems like there's just a perpetuation of this psychopathic, epigenetic or genetic memory of psychopathy that I'm struggling with in terms of what you were talking about, the either or the something and. Can this be evolved? Can we evolve out of this? Or is this something where it is either or and it will forever be that way until perhaps the European no longer exists as a result of their birth dearth?
Well, I don't know if European explains it. I think greed explains it. And that Europeans have manifested the cognitive dissidence by creating the inferior other, the savage, that what Western culture, Western European cultures did prior to the arrival of their presence on the continent of North America was the education of the elite derived as much of it did from ancient Rome provided a rationale as part of their so-called education that justified their treatment of people, their ability or the ease, I should say, with which they viewed certain people as inferior. And so their training and education among the elite provided a mental framework to make that an easy thing to do. And so then when they came into colonial North America, it wasn't hard to then implement that framework of thinking in these ways that annihilated a Native American population and then enslaved women, children, moms, dads, grandparents stolen from Africa. And they could justify it through those mental frameworks. And so, But why How could they do that, you ask? Like, what could, maybe those mental frameworks created a way for their brain to tell them it's okay because they're inferior, because they're savages, and I'm okay for treating them this way because I am elite and Christian and civilized, and the other framework that seemingly made that okay. So
that can it be? Can it be? Okay, hold on. Let me interrupt for a second. Could it also possibly be that when we're looking at, as Jane Elliott said in the beginning of this program, when we looked at the European coming out of the Ice Age, coming out of the caves, that it was also perhaps biological, axiological in terms of survival when they come out and there's a sea of population of pigmented people, that they're saying, oh my gosh, we will become extinct at some point if we do not have some level of cohesion and collusion amongst ourselves. And so therefore we must dominate the entire planet and rule over our women and have the, and so could it be that that level of psychopathy became before
you'd need to talk to an expert in that field. I have no expertise in that, in the area of genetics.
What are your thoughts on it? I know you don't have expertise on it, but just in general, just what would be your thoughts on it?
I always turn to my training in sociology and law, and we're always looking at social constructionism as a principal way to understand most of what we experience in society. And so it's through that desire to attain wealth that I think is the principal motivator. I mean, think about it even today. Like, let's not even dig into that history. Today, am I gonna hand over my real estate, the house that I purchased, that, you know, the bank owns it still, but eventually I'll own it, right? Am I gonna hand it over to tribal people? My greed will allow me to justify why I'm not gonna do that.
Jane Elliott?
Well, right now you don't have to. But in the future, unless we change our treatment of those who are different from ourselves, that could very easily happen. It happened when we, the white people, came into this country and took over what didn't belong to us because we had the power to do it. The main fear that I hear expressed by white people when I talk today is, if they get power, aren't they going to want to do to us what we've done to them? We had better hope, we had better pray. If you pray, you had better pray most religiously that people of color do not want to treat us the way we have treated them. They'll have that power in the future, and they will use that power as they have been taught to use that power, which is a bad idea. When we talk about these savages, remember the Aztecs and the pyramids, and compare that to Stonehenge. Now just think of that single example. People of color built the pyramids and believed that the sun, that God was the sun. The sun was a god, was God. Now today we realize that all energy we have on this earth comes to us from the sun. Perhaps the Aztecs were right. Now there's a really ugly thought. You see, we automatically assume that if our culture wasn't reflected in the cultures of other groups, that the other group's culture was wrong. So we have to be sure that we get them acculturated. And that's what we do in school. It's a bad idea. It's a really bad idea. And if you travel anywhere but in the United States, if you travel to those, as Mr. Trump calls them, the shit countries, you'll find out that they knew more then than we have learned yet. Mm. And we need to appreciate the things that they knew and the things that, one of the main differences, psychologists tell us, or sociologists tell us, that one of the main differences between white people and people of color is, when white people come into a new environment, they immediately adjust the environment to fit their needs. When people of color come into a new environment, they immediately adjust their needs to fit the environment. It's called recognizing your power and recognizing what power you don't have, and refusing to recognize that you don't have the power to change the world. Maybe, just maybe, the people who knew how to live on this continent on this, what we call America, which is not America, is the United States of America. America runs from the northernmost point on the north on the of Canada to the southernmost point of South America. Those people are all Americans. We're going to build a wall to keep those Americans out of America. See, this is how shallow our learning is in this country. We are allowed and we are encouraged and we are reinforced in being ignorant. If you maintain this level of ignorance, you too can be president of the United States. And we have proof of that now. It's about power and the use and misuse of power.
Right.
Sorry.
My presence is showing there. I didn't know that was coming. That was really good. That was really good. That was brilliant.
Just use, if you want to make an instant difference in people, compare the pyramids to Stonehenge. And which took a whole lot
brilliant.
More intelligence and knowledge and expertise to do it. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does. Yes. Well, last question to you, Jane. And we talked about it in the green room. If you would be so kind, I saw the book, ladies and gentlemen, is A Collar in My Pocket, The Blue Eyes, Brown Eyes Exercise. It's an amazing book. It's a must have, must read, and a must understanding for education. And what I loved the most and was most painful to read in this book was the acknowledgments that you gave to your children in particular, because they had to endure being children of a parent, a mother, who for many of us would say will go down in history in changing the minds of millions. As a result of you showing up 54 years ago in presenting this work. Can you speak to us about some of the things that you have had to live through in terms of with your children?
Oh, what I've had to live through is nothing compared to what my children lived through. They were beaten, they were spit on, their belongings were destroyed, they were verbally and physically and psychologically abused by their peers, by their teachers, and by the parents of their peers because they had an N-word lover for a mother. And my children turned out just beautifully, as far as I'm concerned. But now I have to relive that guilt for what I did, because of what I did, what it did to my children. My oldest son is dying of cancer. And I think if what I had done, I hadn't done that, he wouldn't have had those stresses. He would have behaved in a different way. Maybe he wouldn't be in the situation he is. And that's unreal. And that's ridiculous. And that's stupid. And the two things are not connected. But he suffered enough when he was a kid. But what we suffered is nothing compared to what Black children suffer all day, every day. Absolutely nothing. Because that was a small group of people in Riceville, Iowa, doing it to my children. All we had to do was get them out of there. And they could go their happy way and not be recognized. Unless they happen to mention that I was their mother. Now, in the last 15 or 20 years, it's been a good thing to have me for a mother and to be able to say, yeah, that's my mother. But my son, because he works on large equipment, said, Mom, keep a low profile when you come to my house because I could get killed on the job. The people I work with would not put up with having somebody like who has a mother like you on the job with them. So it just goes on and on and on. Now, if I hadn't done the exercise, I wouldn't have to worry about it. I am responsible for what I now have to worry about. That's the way it is. You put your head above the parapet and somebody's going to try and shoot it off. So you can either decide to put your head above the parapet or you can stay beneath lower than the wall and let it go on. I don't have the right to just let it go on. My dad said, you have a choice to make. You can either make a dollar or make a difference. My brothers became civil engineers. My sisters and I became teachers. They made the dollars. My sisters and I have made a difference.
Yes, you have.
Education is the answer to all these problems. Education is the answer to this problem.
Jane Elliott, I love you and appreciate you. And of course, you are welcome back on this program and platform anytime you choose to do so. Thank you for this meaningful work, your meaningful life. I just can't thank you enough. And Dr. Battalora, You have enlightened us for probably about a year and a half, 2 years almost, and with your wonderful work, Birth of a White Nation. And I really am honored by being able to, I said, you know, out of all the people I've had on my show, I think, wouldn't it be really great to bring two great, if you will, European historians to this program to talk about their perspectives from a chronological perspective as well as a historical perspective. And this has been absolutely enlightening and amazing. So I thank you, Dr. Battaglia, for your contribution and work.
I'd like to express a public thanks to Jane Elliott, for whom, without her courage and the pain that she endured with her family and standing up the way that you have stood up, that you continue to stand up, to be an exemplar example of what a human being at her best looks like, I would never have written the book that I wrote. I wouldn't have done it. You have paved a path that has shaped thinking, that has shaped my heart, and I am forever indebted to you. Thank you.
You're most welcome, but nobody needs to thank me for what I do. It's what human beings do, ought to be doing, in order to make other human beings more human and more aware and more appreciative of those who are around them. You can't live without the people who are around you. Yes. Surround yourself with members of your family, and you are all members. You may not like it, but you are all members of my family. Get used to it.
You give us a bit of hope in the African community that maybe some of these European people might be able to change and alter certain aspects of their genetics to become human, to become part of the human race and the human family, to understand what humanity looks like and what it really means. I appreciate you both. Stick around with me in the green room as we sign off in our 6 second delay. Family, if you would, of course, like, share, comment. I know you're going to comment. Oh boy. Lord, I know you're going to comment. So I'm just asking you to comment well so that you don't get blocked and deleted. So, and don't put links in the doggone comments because they go into the YouTube spam and they get deleted. But we want to hear from you and we want to know if, you know, maybe we missed something. I don't know. Maybe Jane might want to come back and maybe do this again. We'll see. But regardless of the fact, we love you. We'll see you guys next time on the Philippe Matthews Show.